You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. In addition to being the land of enchantment, New Mexico was once also the land of bewitchment. Witches used to streak across the skies as fireballs, creep along the streets as black cats, and flutter into the trees in the form of owls. These are just some of the encounters that my guest this week, John LeMay, dissects as he delves into encounters, first-hand accounts, tribal nation lore, and a whole lot more. This expansive and detailed collection, titled The New Mexico Book of Witches, collects articles, reports, files, witness statements, and some absolutely incredible photographs in an amazing collection covering all aspects of witchcraft in this state. But before we get there, as always, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, early releases, bonus content, and more. Don't forget you can click the link in the show notes as always. We're also on Apple Podcasts, so you can sign up there if you would prefer. And thank you to each and every one of my patrons who continue to help support the show every month. It is always deeply appreciated. Mysteries and Monsters is across all social media platforms. Please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. You can also visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for merchandise, news, and episodes. Thank you, as always, to the marvellous Weary Pines for my intro and outro music. Thank you, of course, to Dean Bestor for his marvellous artwork. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange network. So, the land of enchantment awaits us, but beware. Not everything is clearly as it may seem. I welcome back our good friend John LeMay to discuss his latest book, The New Mexico Book of Witches. A state steeped in folklore, myth and mystery, New Mexico can probably consider itself the witchiest state in the lower US. No wonder they call it the Land of Enchantment. John's latest book is a rich history of witchcraft from this amazing and inspiring state. John, welcome.
Hello, Paul. It's always good to be on your show.
It's always good to have you on, especially with a tome such as this. John, when I saw this subject, and I know the last time we spoke, you tantalized us with this upcoming project. I have to say, as we've just been joking about, well, not joking about, I was not expecting a book as big as this, and I found it incredible that essentially what I thought I knew about witchcraft in this particular area of the US is obviously mostly wrong.
Yes, New Mexico witchcraft is very different from, like, let's see, Salem, Massachusetts, where the witches ride brooms and have black cats. You know, here in New Mexico, they ride pumpkins or they turn into fireballs. It's a totally different thing.
Well, I think the one thing that seems to be prevalent in all of this, in the origins of everything here, which I think is one of those things that often gets overlooked, because New Mexico and the area that became New Mexico is one of those places that the name predated Mexico. It's been known as that particular type of area for a long time as the Spanish moved north up from below. And so we've kind of got a bit of a rich history here that probably predates a lot of other states in America, John, because obviously a lot of people were coming across in a sort of Western expansion as the colonists came from Europe on that particular side. Whereas here we've got articles and documents and history that goes back to the end of the 15th and 16th centuries.
Yes, in that regard, New Mexico is a bit similar to Florida, which has, you know, the oldest continually inhabited settlements in the United States. New Mexico, we have this very unique pueblo. It's so cool. It's called Sky City or Acoma, And it's this pueblo that was built literally on top of a mesa, and it is one of the oldest continually inhabited settlements here in North America.
Is it surprising, as a resident and a lover of history, John, that when the subject of witchcraft in the US comes up, predominantly everybody focuses on, as you touched on there, Salem and some of the things that went on in the northeast of the country. And yet here we are, having looked at some of the work and the history that's gone on previously and the work that you've uncovered in the book and some of the other authors and researchers in your particular state have looked at, there were witchcraft trials and people being accused of witchcraft, I think, going back to sort of 1607, which is mind-blowing, I think, for some people who don't really know that much about New Mexico's history.
Yes, and then what's even more mind-blowing is it still goes on today, albeit a bit more rarely. But, you know, in the 1940s, a man was actually taken to court to stand trial for turning into a frog and biting his wife. And that there's real transcripts and newspaper articles about it. You know, it's not folklore. This actually happened. Maybe not necessarily that he turned into a frog, but at least that he stood trial for that.
Mm. I mean, as someone that's as much a lover of history as you are of the weird, John, when you decided to tackle this project, was this a subject that you'd always been interested in? I mean, my understanding and interest in this particular area of the US's witchcraft history was predominantly based on seeing a gentleman called Robert Martinez a few years ago doing some interviews on YouTube, which really sort of opened my eyes to this whole kind of phenomenon and belief system that exists in New Mexico, which seems to be a real sort of cultural mixture of Spanish, Pueblo, Native American, and then obviously later on you've got other sort of people moving into the areas. It seems like it's a completely unique version of witchcraft that most people wouldn't know about, or perhaps don't know the full picture of just how varied it is in New Mexico.
And I'll also vouch for Robert Martinez's presentations. He's the state historian, and I'm glad you saw some of his presentations on the topic, because they're fascinating and they helped inspire me to do the book. But you know me, I've always been into cryptozoology and, you know, monsters that might be real. I was probably less interested in witches, because, you know, they're just basically human beings as opposed to like dinosaurs or Sasquatch. I think why they intrigued me was I loved the old Hammer horror films with Peter Cushing and Christopher Lee. And I think I was just pondering, you know, if they were to have done a movie set in 1850s or the mid 1800s New Mexico, like, what would their source material be? What were vampires like in New Mexico, or what were witches like? And I think that piqued my interest in the topic, and they're so distinctly different than just, again, you know, the witches of Salem that traditionally ride brooms and all that. And I think what I really like about New Mexico witches that makes them stand apart and maybe makes them a little more monstrous is that they supposedly had the ability to turn into owls.
Yes.
Yeah, that was a very common story, that a hunter would see an owl up in the tree, and he would get a suspicion that maybe it was a witch spying on him, so he would etch a cross onto his bullet. Then he would shoot the owl, and then the next day an alleged witch would be found dead. And they would always say, well, because he shot the owl and the witch's spirit was in the owl, you know, her body back home died.
Mm. I know some people would always say, if you'd had an encounter or a brush with a witch and you managed to injure them, you would have to then start to look for anybody in the village or in the local area who had a bandage on or something, because that would then prove that was what you'd shot in the time previous.
Oh, yes, exactly. Yeah, I guess I should have said that variation of the tale, too, because, yeah, obviously mine was only if I actually killed them. But yeah, if you like clip their wing, then maybe their arm would be injured the next day. So absolutely.
So obviously, as the Spanish expansion moved forwards into the lower US as it is now, John, they were obviously coming with a very stringent version of Catholicism at that particular point. Was it a case of that this was anything that they didn't recognize was considered to be witchcraft, whereas we would just consider it in with our modern eyes and our more open-mindedness that this was simply people practicing native customs that had been passed from generation to generation. They were just following their beliefs.
Sort of both. So I think to answer that question, I'd like to kind of highlight the belief of the Apache tribe, which is the one that's closest to me in my part of southeastern New Mexico. And the Apache really intrigued me because they're I don't know if I'd really call it a religion, but their belief system wasn't entirely unlike the Jews of the Old Testament, because the Apache had only one god that they called Usen. And to connect with Usen, you had to go out into the wilderness and fast for about 4 days. And then Usen would basically connect with you, and the Usen would give you with this intuitive spiritual power that, again, really isn't dissimilar to Judaism or Christianity. You know, like some Apache would have, you know, again, the ability of spiritual intuition, foresight. Some of them would have power over snakes, which the Apache considered to be evil. Because, you know, there's that scripture about in the Bible about handling serpents and them not harming you and things like that. So the irony is the Apache kind of believed similar things to what the Catholics already believed. But because the Apache expressed it in a totally different way, you know, the Catholics still considered them to be pagan, heretical people, even though I think really the Apache were praying to the exact same God as the Catholics, just by a different name. But I guess what I'm really trying to get around to, though, is the Apache, when they would make their connection with Usen and the spirit world, they would receive what they simply called the power. And the power is very much like the Force in Star Wars. Mm. So when you had the power, you could use the power for good or for evil. Again, just like Star Wars with the Force, where you have the Jedi and the Sith. So it was really very simple. You know, it was kind of like the power was in you, and it was all up to how you decided to use it. So if you used the power for evil, the Apache considered you to be a witch, and it was that simple. If you used your power for good, you were just a medicine man, which was basically their version of a priest. So, you know, again, in the Spanish's eyes, you know, the medicine men and the witches, to the Spanish, they were both witches. But to the Apache, the medicine men were good, and they were basically, like I said, like priests. And the witches were witches. So the Native Americans all did have their witches among them, which they despised. But the medicine men were always like their priests. Like you said, the Spanish couldn't really tell the difference, but the indigenous peoples themselves certainly could.
Mm. It is interesting. I think that's one of the things that applies to all cultures, John, because there were very similar things that happened here in the UK during our brush with witchcraft and the witch trials of the 17th century. I'm not really sure if it was the same in some other parts of Europe, notably France and Germany, which were also obsessed with seeing witches everywhere at one particular point in time. Whereas here, it was a very similar thing that the local medicine man or sorcerer or whatever name they gave him would usually be left to carry on, whereas the women were very, very put down upon in regards to even if they were doing the same things, they were seen to be evil for whatever reason. I find that striking, that we look at somewhere half a world away and there's still that similar concept that for whatever reason, men are practicing good magic and women must be practicing evil magic, which is remarkable when we look at, you know, these cultures had absolutely no contact whatsoever.
Yes, definitely. There's always been this weird stigma against women. So that's interesting that you point that out as well.
Was this something that applied to some of the other tribal nations in that particular area as well, John? Because obviously the other aspect of New Mexico is there are several Native American tribes that were based there, which, you know, as you've mentioned there about the Apache, but I know that the Hopi were there, we had Navajo there, it seemed, and I know as other people have said over the course of history, a lot of spiritual leaders and people of all faiths seem to think that there is something special about New Mexico, whether it's the remoteness, whether it's the terrain, the topography. It seems somewhere where people can find themselves and follow whichever path of spirituality they believe. Is that something that you think is still prevalent in people that come to New Mexico in the modern era?
Yes, because there's a lot of different spiritual beliefs up in the Santa Fe Taos region. you know, and some of them, you know, some are good and some are darker, you know. But yeah, so I mean, there's definitely quite a mix of different beliefs here in New Mexico for sure.
Mm. I'm not sure if that's the reason why the U.S. government build a lot of special places there, John, but you never know.
Yeah, I do wonder about what makes certain spots of land special, you know. So there probably is something special about New Mexico.
Mm. I think it is one of those states, like I say, that if you'd have asked me 10 years ago to tell you things about New Mexico, I'd be struggling outside of knowing about Albuquerque and Roswell. I really would.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know far more than I ever thought I could ever do. It seems to be a real magnet for people who are very connected with any kind of sort of alternative lifestyle, John. I mean, there's a massive art scene that's growing in the state. It seems to be very forward thinking in some aspects, and yet sort of politically people are quite conservative. They're not, you know, it's obviously currently a Democratic state, and it's one of those states that if you win New Mexico, it tends to give an idea of who might be president next. So
yes, yeah,
but I think it just strikes me, as we were joking before we started the interview, I'm amazed at how many people allegedly don't believe New Mexico is in the States. It's because it's not like it's out of its way anywhere, you know. It's nestled in next to Texas and Arizona and you've got the Colorado and things above it. It's not like it's out there on a island, or it's stuck sort of pushing right down into the Mexican borders or into the hinterlands, John. It's on the border with all the other southern states. So I find it odd. It's why do you think it gets overlooked so much?
That is interesting, because you'd think if anything, people might forget that Hawaii is a state, because again, it's an island, or Alaska, because it's way up there and kind of disconnected. But yeah, New Mexico, like you said, it's right between Texas and Arizona. I think it's just the name New Mexico. People think maybe that it's its own country, or just the northernmost part of Mexico. They just have a hard time grasping that it is a state, although it was one of the last states, because it became a state in 1912. So it's still relatively new compared to some of the other ones.
Yeah, I think it would be galling. You know, you're one of the lower 48, and yet you always get overlooked.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
When you look at this whole history, Johnny, you know, as you said, you love your history, you love your weird things. Are you surprised at just how much documentation there is in regards to witchcraft in the state, and how many different cultures all had the same sort of beliefs? As you mentioned, the Apaches had a very strong belief system. You had the Spanish bringing their version of it. You had... Surprised that you've got all these cultures that sort of all came to the same area, that all had a belief in one particular thing, as in witchcraft, but they all had very different interpretations of what witchcraft meant to them.
Yes, and you touched on this earlier when you talked about the Native Americans and the Spanish coming into conflict. And what's interesting about that is eventually Native American Pueblo witchcraft really blended in with the Spanish witchcraft from Spain and made its own unique New Mexican variety of it, which I think is just fascinating.
Mm. I was struck as well by when you're talking about sort of the Apache and the Navajo, that for a lot of people, when it comes to ghosts, they would think that they are a separate thing, but both of those nations believe that witches could send ghosts after people, which I've never come across here in European folklore and witchcraft, John. That's not something I've seen a lot of, if at all, really. And yet, this was one of the many weapons of choice that if you upset the wrong person or did something that upset somebody, there was a chance that a practitioner of witchcraft would send a ghost after you, which I find it's one of those things that makes me chuckle, because I think, wow, that's a whole new level of something else that's going on here.
Yeah, the Navajo, their word for ghost is chindi, and it's definitely interesting, and it's one of those things I almost wish that show Supernatural would have done an episode on, because I don't think they ever did one on the Navajo and the chindi. And but I mean, the Navajo belief system, particularly their view of witchcraft, you know, it's just rife for possibilities when you're working in the realm of fiction. So there's, you know, a lot to play with. Although it's some people think that's not right, because the Navajos are very, very private when it comes to things like Chindi and skinwalkers. They're very taboo. And it was the New Mexico writer Tony Hillerman who kind of helped popularize them, because he wrote these very famous, well-received novels starring Jim Chee and Joe Leaphorn, which were tribal detectives. And they would typically be investigating things like skinwalkers and Chindi. And so thanks to Hillerman, you know, this concept kind of got out into the world. And for anyone who wants to see more of that, AMC just started adapting those novels into a TV series called Dark Winds.
Ah, fabulous. Well, that's always interesting, because like you say, I think when it comes to this particular subject, and I know obviously in this day and age, people are a lot more culturally sensitive, John, about making sure that if they are going to adapt things like this, that they portray them in the spirit that they've been created. When it comes to things like Supernatural and perhaps Grimm as well, which was another sort of monster of the week kind of show, do you think for a lot of people who don't delve into these subjects a lot, they concentrate on the two big ones, which are sort of La Llorona and La Llorona, in regards that they are, as far as everybody outside of being involved in it, are what people would conceive to be Mexican witchcraft, and that would also bleed into New Mexico.
Yeah, and actually, you know, you talked about La Llorona, and that was the first episode of Supernatural,
yes,
the Wailing Woman, and so that's they did at least hit on her.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, I think it's definitely debatable whether or not La Llorona was a witch or just a ghost, and that's one of those things where the lines kind of get crossed.
Hmm. Was it very similar as well? Because I know they believe that, as we do here in Europe, that witches had this ability to transform into certain animals, and I know that we've mentioned owls. Was it, as it could be over here, that they had a whole zoo of creatures that people would believe?
Yeah, to the best of my knowledge, there's a list of 13 animals that witches can supposedly transform into in North America. And, you know, but at the top of the list here in New Mexico is typically always owls or coyotes or black cats. But I think something our listeners will find interesting is the European werewolf really isn't like how it's portrayed in movies like The Wolfman, where the guy gets bitten by a werewolf and he turns into one unwillingly. In European folklore and the beliefs of the time, witches were werewolves. You were never really a werewolf by accident. You know, you always made a pact with the devil, and you had like a special fur pelt you would wear and incantations you had to do to transform into a wolf. So it's, you know, totally different from the movies, which really never chose to portray werewolves as witches and warlocks and things like that.
That is interesting, because obviously people don't prescribe canines to be part of the witch's menagerie at all in
yeah.
Usually, John, it's always felines, it's cats, it's always a black cat. Whereas on reading your book, I found it really eye-opening that it seems that there are a whole range of creatures that could be, like you say, coyotes and things like that. Was that different for each tribal nation, or was it there was this, as you say, this list of 13 that applied to everybody's belief systems?
Yes, with the tribal nations, they did have some specific differences. You know, I mean, a lot of times it would be a coyote, but for some reason, the Apache zeroed in on bears. They thought that witches like to turn into bears more often than not, and they also believed that some dead Apache who had made mistakes in this life would be reincarnated as a bear for some reason. But yeah, and then some of them would believe that the witches would turn into turkeys, of all things.
Right.
So they had some odd picks as opposed to wolves, owls, and things like that.
Yeah.
But I actually came up with a theory as to this whole owl thing, the witches and the owls.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't put it in my book because I felt like it would be too much. But I don't feel like it's too much for our listeners, so I'll share it here if you don't mind.
Of course.
Okay, so my theory, and again, you won't get this in the book because I felt like most readers of the book are just going to have this general curiosity. And if I put this theory out there, most of them, I feel like, couldn't handle it and just wouldn't respect my sanity anymore. But I mean, you know, Paul, when you research this stuff and you see like how many people, I think this is relatable. When you see just how many people have seen a Sasquatch, you really can't be skeptical about it. It doesn't matter that they haven't found a Bigfoot body yet or whatever. I mean, too many people see these things and you can't write it off. And so I looked at these accounts of the witches and all these people who claim that the witches turned into owls. And I was like, okay, how would this actually work if this were real? And my little conclusion is, no, they never actually turned into an owl. I don't believe that. That's too much. But here's something that we know from people's experiences spiritually. And this pertains to people of faith and also people not of faith. There are lots of people who have had near-death experiences where they claim that their spirit left their body and they floated above their body and they looked down and observed themselves from outside of themselves. So, you know, there's a lot of people who have experienced that, again, whether they have faith or no faith. Mm. So, I mean, I think people can agree that happens.
Yeah.
And then there are also people who claim that they can astral project and actually willingly make their spirits leave their bodies. And another concept to take into hand before I put out my theory is, you know, there's also the stories about people being possessed by other spirits like demons and, you know, and then they get exorcised. And, you know, that goes to show that another spirit can enter another person's body. So my train of thought was, if these stories are actually real and a lot of people say they are, I think what happens is that these practitioners of witchcraft astral project themselves out of their body, and then their spirit possesses the body of an owl or whatever animal it is. So they don't actually transform into the animal. But I mean, I feel like if a demon spirit can possess a human body, why could not a human spirit perhaps possess an animal's body for a while? Mm-hmm. And maybe that's where these stories come from. So that was my theory that I felt was too much for the book and I left out, but I almost put it in there.
Well, it seems, to be honest, when you talk about magic and witchcraft and spiritualism, it seems a fairly logical step, in my opinion, John. I don't think it's that far out of theory in the slightest.
Yeah, because one of my pet peeves is, so obviously there's skeptics out there, and skeptics will put more effort into disproving these stories than believers will put into trying to actually understand them. Because most believers in these stories, they're just kind of like, well, that's just the way it works. They don't actually think of how it works, you know?
Yeah.
So I wanted to actually think, well, how would this work? Yeah. You know, because I don't think for a second anybody transformed into an actual owl, but there was just too much to it. So that, to me, was the most logical explanation.
Absolutely. And it seems to be something in the modern pantheon of fantasy literature as well, John.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of wizards and witches have the ability to – they'll cast a spell to say, oh, I will have the sight of an eagle, and then all of a sudden you'll see a bird flying high in the sky, and they're able to look – through the bird's eyes onto wherever they're trying to go, or they will mm-hmm. use a wolf or something. So if we're talking about magic, I don't think anything's off the table, is it really?
No, I don't think so. I think we've been taught to be skeptical.
Mm. I mean, one of the highlights amongst many in this particular book, John, is some of these incredible photos that you've got from the turn of the 20th century. Some of the ones in the section covering the Navajo and the Apache, I just love things like this, because I've very rarely seen images as striking and as beautiful as powerful as are included in this book for someone with a very limited knowledge of Native American traditions. So when I'm looking at the section where you're covering these, and it discusses the monster hunters, or the twin heroes, or the twin hero gods, depending on who you speak to, I'm amazed, and I know you've put in the book there that these are often misdescribed as people pretending to be skinwalkers. or saying that they're skinwalkers, whereas they're enacting these heroic tales. So what were the twin gods? What is this? Were they monster hunters? Were they witch killers? Or were they just heroes of that particular belief system? Because when I saw these images, they were striking. I would imagine they would terrify somebody if they weren't aware of what they were 150 years ago, John.
Yeah, the hero twins are such a rich mythology. So first of all, I'll apologize because I've actually done that mistake of printing a picture of one of the hero twins or the dancer representing the hero twins and saying that it was a skinwalker. I did that in my book, Cowboys and Monsters, and my friend Justin Mullis politely corrected me and told me, no, that's actually a ceremonial dancer depicting exactly who would have been out killing the skinwalkers, and they just get mislabeled. So I'm so glad I got it right for this book. But I'm definitely drawn to the hero twins for some inexplicable reason, because I'm using them in my series of novels called 21 Guns, and I think we talked about one I did called Once Upon a Time in Fort Sumner,
yes,
which has Skinwalker as the villain, and then the I have these twin brothers who are like a modern incarnation of the hero twins. So, I was just, again, very inexplicably drawn to this concept of the hero twins. And they are almost like the Native American equivalent of Jesus, I guess, in a weird way, even though there's two of them.
Yeah.
Because, again, you know, you can read a lot of the Native American creation stories, and it's quasi-similar, again, to the Bible, because they have this, they all have this story about a flood and, you know, one creator. But the hero twins are typically like the savior of the world who come here and they slay the monsters and make the earth a safe, habitable place to live. And one represents the divine masculine and one represents the divine feminine, even though one doesn't have to be a boy or a girl. It's really interesting. And it's a very rich side trip into spirituality, and I think it's just almost too much to even get into on this podcast, but it's really fascinating.
I mean, I'd never heard of it until I'd read your book, John, at all, so I'm blown away by this. And I find it, as you say, I think because a lot of this information and this culture has been suppressed or pushed aside or diminished until sort of the last 40 or 50 years, where it's sort of coming back and people are really looking at these subjects and these beliefs with the respect that they deserve. I'd never come across this at all. I find it fascinating, especially for the Navajo, to have this intrinsic belief of these twins of good coming back to protect the nation, as it were.
Yeah, and I would love to know, like, what is the originating source of these hero twins? Like, what truth lies in that story of these divine twins that, you know, kind of like saved the world? Because I definitely think there's some truth to it, because why else would all of the indigenous peoples of North America have these stories about these hero twins?
This is one of those things where I think often people will try and lump all tribal lore into one big pot, John, and not, you know, that doesn't work, because and I've said this to other people when we're talking about other subjects like the Wendigo or Bigfoot, that why are tribes living in the south of North America got similar stories to tribes living in Canada? That because there's no way these guys have ever met. You know, they're what, 6,000-7,000 miles away. There's no way that these guys have ever had any sort of cross pollination. So why have they got the similar stories? How has that happened? So there has to be a kernel of truth in some of these, similar to the Thunderbird. There has to be a kernel of truth that originated for all these nations and tribes around the North American continent, John, that they've all gone forwards in their isolation with similar stories that you can kind of cross examine together and think, well, they're basically talking about the same thing here.
Yeah, I think one truth I've really learned over the past year is, irregardless of what the world teaches you or tells you, the real truth is pretty obvious. It's always simple and it's obvious. And I mean, you just said it, they all have the same belief, therefore it must have been true in some sense.
I mean, there are some things that are just
I just, like I said, this book is just fascinating because there's so many things that I wasn't aware of. This belief that certain cultures had that witches eat the dead and they would dig up bodies, because some tribes would bury their relatives with their personal possessions to either as a gift to travel on into the next life, or to stop greedy relatives from stealing them. But
yeah,
I know some tribes also thought that that's why witches dug people up, so they could get to their prized possessions. It was kind of like a really conflicting belief system that they say, well, that's why they dig people up, but we've got to do it anyway.
Yeah, yeah. And again, that was kind of a big part of those cool Tony Hillerman murder mysteries. It would always be like, well, was the victim murdered by a witch so they could get their possessions? And
yeah, yeah. It's just fascinating. There's so much that you uncover, I suppose. I mean, even with your experience, John, I would imagine when you undertook this project, you must have got to a point where you were just uncovering things that you'd either never come across, or, as we were talking about, the incorrectly labelled photographs of people at the turn of the last century. Was it a case that you had to keep pushing your jaw up because you were just discovering stuff that left you open-mouthed?
Yeah, definitely. And I'm someone who loves to ferret out the truth and find correlations, you know, in the story. So that was probably the most fun part for me. And a big part of it, though, was kind of just researching the mythos and the beliefs for this 21 Guns series I'm working on that has the hero twins that fight the monsters. And kind of like I said earlier, I like the old Hammer movies. And I always liked how the Hammer movies had their rules about how you would defeat the vampire. You had to do this and do that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I kind of wanted to figure that out for my own novels. You know, how do you defeat the Skinwalker, which is typically the lore has something to do with white ash.
Yeah.
And then but I mean, how you defeat the witches is always interesting. There's lots of different ones. Some of them are really silly, but one is that you were supposed to be named Juan or John. You know, Juan is the Spanish variation of John.
Mm-hmm.
And supposedly, if you're named after John the Baptist, you have a special power to capture witches.
Uh-huh.
And so if your name was Juan, you would turn your shirt inside out because somehow that deflects the bad energy or something like that.
Yeah.
And you would get a stick and you would draw a circle in the dirt, and you would, like, if you saw a fireball streak across the sky, you would call to it and it would turn out to be a witch, and it would be like trapped in the circle. And I don't know, it's just like there's a lot of weird rituals to it. So, like, again, if you're writing a piece of fiction, it gives you a lot to play with.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the other parallels that I found really striking is this belief in shooting sorcery, where people believe that inanimate objects and even animals could be placed inside people, John, if they'd cross the wrong path or that, once again, upset the wrong person. Which, really, once again, I was just amazed immediately, because here in the UK, we have a belief in the fae of people or animals being fairy shot, where if you upset the fae, they could make your animals ill, they could make a person ill, they could destroy crops. And yet here we have, 6,000 miles away in New Mexico, we have a belief of shooting sorcery where people who practice witchcraft could inflict pain by placing inanimate objects and animals inside people, which I just found jaw-dropping because I'd never come across that, especially the animals bit. And some of the reports that you've got in the book about people claiming to have removed live chicks from inside people.
Yeah. Yeah, again, it just goes to show that it's everything weird and supernatural seems to be connected, just like how fairies are also very similar to extraterrestrials, or what are perceived as extraterrestrials, because they're little people that abduct you and you kind of have these hazy memories of your encounters with them, which are typically quasi-sexual. You know, so I mean, fairies and aliens have a lot in common. Even witches and aliens will sometimes have things in common. Like, I have a story in the book about some teenagers outside of Gallup, and one teenager claimed he saw like an alien looking creature, and then a few hours later some other teenagers drove to the same area and they saw a wolfman. You know, so there's always correlations among the world of the strange.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing that really surprised me, and my apologies for my pronunciation here, John, is these little dolls, or monos?
Yeah, I think you're right. I actually have never heard it pronounced myself, but you've done very well with all the Spanish terms. High marks. But yeah, monos. I think, yeah, you said it right, monos.
And I suppose the easiest way to describe it is they seem to be very similar to what we would consider a voodoo doll.
Yeah.
Is that something that was prevalent in a lot of the different nations, or was it a particular nation that believed in this more than any other?
I think it just must be a worldwide thing, because everybody has those little dolls. And I think I used to would have considered this to be kind of heretical to believe this, but I think whatever helps you to believe in what you're doing puts out your own energy. You know, I mean, I don't know that it really matters that there's a voodoo doll or that you did whatever part of the ritual. I almost think that the rituals just help people to believe in what they're doing, and that's how the witches themselves believe, and that's how they kind of exert their spiritual power or influence. That's, you know, the best that I can tell, because some of these rituals are really, really silly. Like I said, like turning your shirt inside out, you know, it's just kind of a strange thing. But if that's what helps you to believe, I think that does something. That's the best way that I can make sense of it.
I suppose as well, one of the things, as we look around us in the modern era, European witchcraft, Wicca, whatever denomination, paganism, whichever denomination people wish to follow these days, is on a real upsurge in Western culture, I would suggest. Probably more so than it has been since people used to get persecuted for it, John. I would imagine, and correct me if I'm wrong, that in certain towns and villages and places in New Mexico and surrounding states, these beliefs have always been there. People have just been quietly going on with their practices, out of the way of things. Has these things sort of come more into the light in the modern era, or is it still sort of on the fringes and you've got to know where to go or be trusted by people for them to open up and admit that they are a practitioner of Bruja?
Gosh, I'd say it's about 50-50, somewhere in the middle.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it's interesting. And there's also these things called curanderos, and then if you're a man, a curandero, which are basically Hispanic faith healers who do some pretty odd things, but they tend to work. Like, they have this weird thing where if you feel like you have a sickness in the body, the curandera will rub like an egg, like a chicken egg. And it can't be like a frozen one. It has to be one, I think, that still has an embryo that has some life to it. And they'll rub it around on you. And then when they crack it open, the embryo will have turned black because it, like, absorbed the sickness. So, you know, they're healers, but their methods are definitely unique and strange, you know?
Yeah. I know there was always this kind of battle that seems to have been going on for time immortal, John, in regards to the people practicing bad magic and people practicing good magic. I've recently seen an episode of Expedition X where they've gone into Mexico, because apparently witchcraft is on the rise again in certain areas of Mexico. And a lot of the people that they were speaking to had this belief of good and bad witchcraft that was still going on. I would imagine that that's still the same in New Mexico as well, that you've got people who are revered in their local communities, that if they've got sickness or illness, or their children are poorly, or things just aren't going right in their life, they will seek out people to bring them good fortune, or to probably suggest that they've been hexed or cursed by someone for some reason and they need it removing. Is that something that you uncovered when you were doing this, and is it something that still goes on?
Yeah, it definitely still goes on. And I'm one of those, I'm hesitant to use the term good magic or whatever. I tend to like to go with what the Apache did, because I think I'm pretty open-minded where the Apache are concerned. Because, again, I'll say that the Spanish and even most Christian people today will consider the old beliefs of the Apache to be pagan, but I don't. Because the way I see it is, you've got this tribe of people that frankly has no Bible to read, but in their hearts, they still know that God is good and God exists. So they go out into the wilderness and they seek him, and he gives them a power. You know, and, you know, like the Apache say, that power can be used for good or for evil. And so that's basically what I believe. I believe bad power is witchcraft. But I don't think you have to call good power good magic or good witchcraft. That's my belief. We all have a certain amount of spiritual power within us. And, you know, again, it's what helps you to believe in that. I think that's – I used to think that sounded like such BS in the movies when they'd be like, oh, yes. If you believe it. And, oh, yeah, I was like – I would roll my eyes. But I'm really learning from what I actually observe that when people truly believe something, it does help it to happen. Mm. And, I mean, you're going to be skeptical of that until you see it happen in your own life. But once you see it, you can't really question it. So, I mean, that's my official stance. I basically agree with the Apache that if you seek God, you will find him. And I do think that we all have good, loving spiritual abilities within ourselves. But if you are a spirit filled with hate and with jealousy and anger, because that's what the Navajo said, they would say that the root of evil witchcraft and witches was jealousy and hatred.
Mm.
So, I mean, I just feel like the indigenous peoples had such a pure, simple view of good and evil. And, you know, I think we overcomplicate things way too much.
Mm. I think it's often easier when people are talking about subjects that they're not very clear on, or that they have to sort of convert it into good and bad, John. And I think, as you say there are always negative traits that lead people down dark paths. And I think, if anything, it just shows you that if you try and lead a positive, supportive, focused life, that good things will happen to you. And it's something that a lot of us forget in the modern world and the busyness of everything that's happening. I think too many people focus on them rather than everything else that they can affect. And I think when we take a step back and begin to sort of unpack everything, life becomes a lot easier when you start to focus on being positive. And yeah, like you say, what I thought I knew and what I believed 5 years ago, I've realized I used to think I was open-minded, John, but I now know I wasn't very open-minded at all.
Yeah, me too. And I mean, again, because I know I'm always going to get this question about good magic and bad magic, and I guess my simple answer is still going to be, if you truly seek God, you'll find him. If you truly seek the devil, you'll find him. So that would be my very simple answer. And I believe that both absolutely exist. So that would be my answer.
Do you think as well a lot of this was down to, especially in New Mexico, John, a lot of the beliefs and the systems that the nations had and the indigenous peoples in the area, a lot of it was also a form of quiet revolution, that they didn't want to conform or be, that they didn't wish to be moved to Catholicism, and therefore staying with their beliefs. For them, it was a form of revolution, of indignation to the outsiders coming in and casting aside everything that they'd ever known.
Yeah, so I think we as human beings always want to see things in black or white. This side was good, that side was bad, and it's never that way. Because the Catholics did some horrible things, and so did the Native Americans. Some of those tribes had horrible, atrocious customs. They had slavery. They had horrible things going on. But then there were other tribes that were really peaceful and good and should have been left on their own, and everything would have been fine. The Catholics should have never messed with them. So again, it's neither side was innocent. And for instance, I have a whole chapter in the book on this Native American leader named Pope. And Pope led the revolution to drive out the Spaniards in the mid-1600s. And just because the Spaniards were being abusive on certain levels, and because he drove them out, you know, Pope is regarded as a hero. But Pope did some horrible, horrible things. He, you know, he had, people were raped and killed unjustly under his rule.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, we just have this very unfortunate need as human beings to, like, make this person the good guy and this person has to be the bad guy, when really they were all a little bit good and a little bit bad. You know, the Catholics should not have forced their religion upon the indigenous peoples. They should have let them come to them willingly if that's what they were interested in. Because if you have to force something on people, obviously there's a problem.
Yeah.
There's really no clear-cut good guy or bad guy in terms of how, you know, the Spaniards came and came into conflict with the Native Americans. They both had good qualities and bad qualities, but they were both, you know, well, I'm getting too far off into the weeds. I better stop. You can have really good intentions and say, you know, I don't know.
Some of the stories as well in the book are quite eye-opening. I know you quote, is it Jack Kutz who did a story about these night watchmen that kept dying, John? And everybody was mystified as to what was killing these night watchmen.
Yeah, so that's a really cool story from the Las Cruces region of New Mexico. And I would guess that's just a little folktale. But I don't believe that one was historically accurate. I think that's more of a campfire tale where this night watchman supposedly encountered a witch out to drain him of his youth, and like he cut off her hand. And it's definitely a good campfire story, but that's not one I believe. But yeah, in this book, I didn't really discriminate against what I thought were just folk tales and what were real historical instances of documented witchcraft. So it's just, you know, a big, big book of every witch story in New Mexico that I could find.
Mm. Well, I think sometimes you've got to include, as you say, these tall tales or campfire stories, because I think often, as we were saying earlier on, often a lot of people spend a lot of time trying to dismiss these stories, especially when they're indigenous beliefs, as superstition and old-fashioned nonsense. But a lot of them are clearly morality tales, John, or
yeah,
guides on how to live your life. The Night Watchman is clearly one of those about don't follow temptation when it comes knocking, because it's usually not going to end well for you.
Oh, that's right, yeah, because we didn't, I didn't say when you asked me about it. Yeah, the story is that the Night Watchman can't see the woman that's speaking to him, but she sounds young and beautiful, and she's, you know, she's trying to tempt him by his sexual desires, and he doesn't give in to that temptation because he just realizes it's too good to be true, and, you know, this is a witch out to get me, and yeah, that was the story.
Are there still areas that children and people are warned to stay away from because of the area is bruja? There used to be places and villages where people would be warned to stay away from. And once again, you could say this is those tales that parents would say to kids to keep them out of the woods or keep them away from the river. Is that something that still exists, that there are certain places that people say, oh, you don't want to go there, it's something not right?
Yeah, I think so. I can't think of any specific ones here in New Mexico, but I mean, there's just certain areas where if you go, you know, you're bound to have quote unquote bad luck or something like that. Or there's just spots with bad vibes because of the history. So definitely.
The one thing as well is, as we're talking about, which is most people would be very surprised, and you cover it a few times in the book, that obviously the European version of a witch, they're always on a broomstick, which is one of those things that I don't think it's very true, but
yeah.
It is what it is. And yet, New Mexico, very similar to Mexico, it's balls of fire or fireballs, John. Is this something that's specific? That certain? I mean, are they a certain colour? Are they a certain size? Or is it any ball of fire? I know, once again, people would say, oh, well, that's just uneducated people misidentifying a meteor or a comet, which I find hard to believe that you would misidentify something high up in the sky compared to something flying straight at you.
Exactly. Excellent point. That's what I would say as well. So in terms of the balls of fire, the only other witch lore I came across where that correlates with was there's also a place in Africa where they believe the witches turn into fireballs and balls of light. But I did have enough courage to put forth my theory in the back of the book about the people who see the balls of light, because I know people today who still see them. They see these dancing fireballs that are obviously not meteors or shooting stars because they're, you know, at eye level. And so, I, you know, again, that was something else I wanted to seriously consider. Well, what would that be? And my best guess, my theory, again, is that that is a witch that is astrally projecting themselves, and the ball of light is actually their spirit out floating around, and it just hasn't maybe found a body to possess or whatever. But that's my best guess, that that's what the ball of light would be, is their disembodied spirit.
Mm. Is it something that still certain historical figures or maybe even people to this day, John, are considered magical. Because I know Geronimo, who was a legend in the Old West, I think a lot of people just imagine him as we were discussing earlier on, once again, a freedom fighter, a good man, whatever, rallying against the oppressive invasion of his territory and his peoples and his lands. And yet, I think unless you're interested in weird things like we are, a lot of people would overlook all the mysticism and magic that was supposed to be around him, that he was supposed to be possessed with supernatural powers. Was this something that a lot of the tribal leaders were prescribed to possessing? And is it something that still goes on in the modern era on the reservations and the tribal leaders that they have today?
Yeah, so Geronimo, yeah, he was special. He had more powers than most, according to what I've read. And he was the fourth child in the family. And the number four was really special to the Apache and a lot of other First Nations people.
Mm.
I don't know why that is. I would guess it would have something to do with the four corners of the wind. The four corners of the land or four corners of the earth, whatever you call it, you know, north, south, east, west,
mm-hmm.
Maybe the four elements, that sort of thing. But yeah, four was a sacred number for them. And Geronimo had some pretty unique abilities. And if Geronimo was a character in the Bible, you know, he would just be like one of those great people of faith that had these holy powers. But again, because he wasn't a Christian, as people would call him, you know, they might look at Geronimo and be like, well, those were evil powers from the devil. And I don't think so. You know, I truly, again, believe that the Apache sought God in their own way and he communicated with them in their own way. So I wouldn't really call what Geronimo was doing was like witchcraft or anything like that. I think that was just Geronimo's power that he garnered through his fast, you know. And I mean, again, you know, you can absolutely see the Apache's side of it. You know, these foreigners have come onto your land and they're just going to take it, you know, which isn't right. But yeah, I'm glad you know about the alleged mysticism of Geronimo, which isn't often discussed. And that's also why supposedly the Skull and Bones Society at Yale stole his skull, is what it is alleged. And that's why his skull is supposed to be special.
Mm. It is surprising that you still have these strange, what we would consider old-fashioned or archaic beliefs as it comes to the power of a vanquished opponent's skull,
mm-hmm.
or perhaps even their heart, John. It once again, we're talking about supposedly learned men in the modern era who still followed some kind of mystic rituals that they believed that this man had these amazing powers, which, coming from people that would say, well, this is all stuff and nonsense, and what do these people know? They've no concept of reality and the real world. And yet here we have people allegedly stealing skulls because they thought it was magic still.
Yeah. So I mean, and that's interesting, you know, that whole skull and bones thing is just fascinating, because, you know, a lot of prominent people supposedly belong to that.
Yes, they did. Even I'm aware of some of the allegations. It's like the American version of the Masons here.
Yes, yeah.
Though I'm sure some people would probably say they're the same thing, no doubt. I mean, obviously, when you create a book of such scope as this, John, I would, as you mentioned earlier, there's some things that you've not included and some subjects that you've not perhaps touched on. Are you eager to discover more? Do you think that this is an untapped resource that we're only really beginning to see the tip of, really? And it's once again, having a relationship and building it with certain tribal nations that a lot of them aren't very forthcoming in sharing their beliefs and their knowledge and their histories in such systems and the way that their belief systems are constructed, because of the way it's been dismissed out of hand in previous times. And now they're sort of, as many people will say, there are certain aspects in regards to the Wendigo and the Bigfoot and Sasquatch where they just don't want to talk about it with people, because they just think, well, what's the point? You're just going to tell us we believe in magic still.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I'm definitely excited to keep learning more. And right now, as opposed to like Native American witchcraft and things like that, what I'm really delving into is Native American creation stories and trying to find how they're similar. And their creation stories are actually a lot like the first Matrix sequel, the Matrix Reloaded.
Yeah.
There's a scene in the Matrix Reloaded where Neo has a conversation with the architect of the Matrix, and you learn this mind-bending history that the Matrix has been created and recreated like several times, and Keanu Reeves's character Neo, who is essentially kind of like that story's version of the Hero Twin. You know, he's been they have this repeating cycle of history over and over again. And that's pretty much what the Native Americans believe, is that there have been all of these previous worlds before us. And, you know, like in the Bible, they have the story of Noah's flood, and that's kind of supposed to be the only destruction of the world that we know of. Well, the Native Americans, the flood was the most recent destruction, and it was only like the third or the fourth one. You know, they talk about worlds before us that were destroyed, and it really makes a lot of sense when you look at the meteor craters on the Earth. You know, it seems because one of the Native Americans' stories of destruction was fire from the sky, which sounds a lot like asteroids hitting the Earth. So they know a lot more than modern science and modern society would give them credit for. So I'm really excited to see how all of their creation stories, what their commonalities are.
Mm, yeah, I think one of the things I'm very surprised at myself in regards to, since I've started doing Mysteries and Monsters, John, is, you know, I'd hold my hand up and say I knew next to nothing about Native American legends and lore or anything to do with the First Nation, probably outside of Bigfoot and Thunderbird. I've discovered, I don't know who is, there's someone who lives in Sheffield who keeps giving fantastic books about all of them away to charity shops, because I'm a real charity shop delver, John. I'm always looking for rare books and odd things, and
oh yeah, me too.
I've probably found half a dozen in the last year or so that are specifically to do with Native American and First Nation customs and lore, totems, petroglyphs, and I just find it fascinating because I knew next to nothing, like I say, about it, and it's such a rich vein of untold knowledge and stories. I just find all of it really fascinating. As we've said earlier on, some of the parallels from different parts of the continent are shockingly surprising, and yet some of them are also extremely different as well, which once again shows you how these tribes would have creation stories or legends or belief systems that were created in isolation, and yet a lot of them would also have very similar stories that you can pick from wherever you want. Are you someone, even with your experience working as an archivist and a lover of history, are you still coming across things that surprise you or you weren't aware of, John, that you presumed you knew all there was to know about a particular subject at a point?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. You know, some people, it's almost like they're afraid to learn. Mm. I'd say don't be afraid to learn. I mean, the truth will always find you. You know, some people are really, they're afraid that they're going to be deceived or something the more they look into life and the world. And I'm just like, nah, you know, the truth is like, it always shines through.
One would hope so. One would hope so. I mean, for anybody who's thinks that they know the scary ones in this particular thing, as we've touched on La Llosa and La Llorona, is there any other character that, for anybody who's not aware of it or has yet to read your brilliant book, John, is there anyone that you've come across that you think, oh, more people need to know about this particular character or this belief?
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess that would be La Llosa, because I think it's a little less known than La Llorona, the Wailing Woman. So La Llosa is basically what I would call a were-owl, like a werewolf, but it's like a person. You know, this is in direct opposition of my theory that, you know, the witches would possess the body of a real owl. But the La Llosa is supposed to actually be a giant owl that like a woman really did transform into an owl. There was even a story of one here in Roswell back, I think, the 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
But La Llosa is pretty cool. I mean, from a standpoint, if you're someone like me who's looking for stuff to enrich your fiction and your stories, I'll definitely be using La Llosa one day in the future. But I think that's probably... Yeah, that's probably would be the one I would highlight that's not as well known as La Llorona.
Yeah. I find it surprising that a lot of these nations have giant owls of varying descriptions. I know that, was it the Comanches have a giant cannibal owl? I believe, John.
And that's from my book, right? Moo Pits.
Yeah.
I think, or maybe that's a different one. Yeah. That came from a book I'd love to endorse called Fossil Legends of the First Americans by Adrian Mayer.
Mm-hmm.
So again, Fossil Legends of the First Americans, for anyone listening. If you're interested in my witch book, you'd also probably really love that book because it's all the myths and legends that Native Americans would. Maybe I almost said legends they came up with. I mean, again, I shouldn't assume that these aren't true stories, but I mean, the idea of the book, though, is that Native Americans looked at dinosaur fossils and created legends around them.
Mm.
So that should be of interest to people who listen to this podcast for sure.
Mm. And it is surprising as well when you think about these cultures and the environment that they grew up in, John, why they would all prescribe such fearsome tales about what we would say, as ferocious animals go, owls would not be the top of most people's lists, John.
No, and for some reason, owls are really associated with evil. And this is something I actually would like to touch upon. The first evil, like, female monster mentioned in the Bible is Lilith.
Yep.
Her name is Lilith, allegedly Adam's first wife before Eve, part of the Apocrypha. And she was basically a female vampire who's associated with owls, so I kind of wonder how those things correlate. And it's not just the Native Americans and the Spanish people with these legends about owls. It's also Sumeria and cultures from the Middle East have these vampiric bird women. So there's something there for sure.
Yeah, it just strikes me as peculiar because when we have all these stories about the dangerous creatures that people would have to deal with, which is bears and wolves, snakes as well often appear in certain ones.
Yeah.
I just find it perplexing that the owl seems to have got a real bad press. I don't know what owls were like 5,000 years ago, John, but clearly they're not the same as what they are now.
Yeah, because, I mean, I get bad vibes from snakes. I don't like snakes, but I like owls. Owls don't really creep me out. I like to see an owl out at night. I think they're cool.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we've got a couple who live around here, and I must admit, every time I hear it hooting at night, it just makes me smile.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Well, it's as a work of art, John, this book is incredible for anybody who's wanting to know anything about these belief systems and the history of witchcraft across the Spanish that moved into the particular area, the native people, the indigenous populations that were there. It's such a rich book of knowledge, of facts, of stories, of newspaper reports and of belief systems. It's an incredible work, John. I can't imagine how much time this has taken to compile and bring for us. Like I said earlier on, you've got some incredible photos. You've got some lovely sections. You give a nod to a lot of other authors and researchers, as we've mentioned, Robert Martinez and Adrian Mayer as well. There are a lot of people that continue to delve into these subjects, and you've collated a wonderful collection for people to dive into. And that's the other aspect of this book as well, is that the way you've sectioned it out, you've kind of broken it into sort of three distinct eras as well, sort of the old, the modern and the new, where people can sort of take a bite-sized chunk and think, oh, well, I want to know about that bit.
Yeah, so it's definitely a great book for someone like me because I like to skip around.
Yeah.
I don't always like to read the whole book or read in order because I'm busy. So, yeah, if you like books that you can skip around, this is a good one for that. I don't think you need to be intimidated by the size. I think the only part of the book you have to read is the introduction.
Mm-hmm.
But after you read the introduction, I think you can just skip around wherever you want and pick out what interests you.
Absolutely. So, John, where can everybody get a hold of it? And what's coming up next for you as one of the busiest men I've ever met in my life? No doubt you've probably got about 17 projects on the go.
Oh, yeah, always. And that's funny you say 17, Paul. That number pops up a lot in my life lately. It's a very random number, but you chose that one. So
I did.
That's funny. Yeah, 17 pops up a lot.
Right.
Anyways, but yeah, books on Amazon. That's the easiest way. That's really where I prefer people to get it, just on Amazon. And I'll probably do a sequel called The New Mexico Book of Monsters, which will be more geared towards cryptids and folkloric creatures that escaped the scope of the witch book, again, because it's such a big book. And, you know, for anyone that loves fiction, in addition to nonfiction, my novel Once Upon a Time in Fort Sumner, you know, again, that's all about the Hero Twins and Skinwalkers thrown in with Billy the Kid. So I'm definitely trying to get that book and its sequels off the ground. So those are probably the two things I'd like to mention.
Yeah, along with your numerous film works as well, John.
Yeah. Oh, and I do. I mean, I guess a lot of your listeners like my Cowboys and Saurians series. That's, you know, newspaper articles about dinosaurs. I did a new one of those. It's just out now called Settlers and Serpents, which is all the best giant snake stories of the Old West.
I've seen a few of those before, John, and there are some remarkable stories about people encountering gigantic snakes in the Old West.
I even have one in the witch book too about the giant rattlesnake of Pecos Pueblo, so there's even some monsters in the witch book as well.
Yes, if you're not satisfied with giant owls, there's giant snakes as well.
Yeah.
Well, John, it's always a pleasure. Thank you, as always, for spending some time talking about this brilliant book and everything else we've ever spoke about. Hopefully, I will speak to you again in future, and I wish you the very best of luck with all your forthcoming projects, and hopefully we will speak again.
Oh, thank you, Paul. I can't wait to be on here again, so just let me know.